Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
My neighbor had some in the attic. Anyway, let's move on here. Mendy, is it Richard or Richard, ma'am?
Oh, Richard.
I figured it was. Mendy Richard, Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Office of Public Health, joins us now. Good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Busy, I guess. Thank you for taking the time with us. Real quick, we're talking about animals, and I see now that a tiger in, I think, the Bronx Zoo or wherever it is has been diagnosed with COVID. Is that significant at all?
Not for us. We focus on humans.
No, but I mean in terms of the virus going from human, I guess it came from animals initially, and then going from, I guess, humans to tigers. I don't know. Does that tell us anything about the virus itself?
Well, I can't speak to that. I don't think, to be honest, Tommy, I don't think at this point we really know as much about this virus as we want to know. So we don't know when these things crop up, how that really is going to impact our human transmission. So at this point, I'd say, you know, the verdict's still out on some of this.
We haven't, you're up against it just trying to test people, let alone animals. Take us through, I guess, when this really started to put pressure on the lab and how it's changed up until now. Because when did this really, you know, I tried to get a timeline on COVID because now it all seems as though it just blurs together. When did this really become an issue for you at the state testing lab?
Yeah, I think it's appropriate today that we're having this conversation. This is actually National Public Health Week.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, we're focusing on a lot of the public health work. But, you know, this really began for our state public health lab right after Mardi Gras. We got our first kit from the CDC. So in the beginning, if you'll remember, it was the state public health labs were the only ones doing the testing. And that first kit came in on Wednesday, right after Mardi Gras, and in the laboratory, we do what we call validate or ensure that our methodology is ready to roll, and we did that in 2 days and got our first sample on Saturday, February 29th. So while that seems like such a long time ago, it really wasn't, and so we had our first positive sample on March 9th. So we were running a few samples in the beginning, but then, of course, after that first positive came through on that Monday, 1 week later, we were receiving around 60 samples a day, which, again, at the time seemed like a lot, but it pales in comparison to today. And then just 2 weeks after that, we were receiving 250 samples a day. And I think it's important to note that the samples that come to the public health lab are the samples that are the folks that are hospitalized, who are the most critical and the most vulnerable. One of the things that I think a lot of people don't realize about the public health lab is that the breadth and scope of the testing that we do. So we do things like water testing, you know, when there's contamination of a water system, we do that testing. We do if there's food poisoning, you know, we test the food in some cases. And then these are the same folks that test for flu and measles and mumps whenever there's a suspected cluster of activity for anything that might become an outbreak or a pandemic. And so we do a lot of different testing, and the real story here is these unsung heroes do this all the time, and right now they are really having to ramp up, as you can see, very quickly in a very short amount of time.
So how do you do that when this is something in China, right? And then it's suspected that it's here. And I know it's a gross oversimplification, but how do you have the materials to test to see if it's COVID? That's what confuses me. Do you always have these on hand or something, or is it a different test specific to COVID?
It is. It is. And so the test is similar to some of the other respiratory testing that we do, but I think it's a great testament to the testing industry because they developed the test and got it out on the street through CDC very quickly. Mm-hmm. And then the manufacturing companies followed very quickly after that with additional methods and instrumentation. And so, yeah, it's a little bit of a twist on what we normally do, but it's a very specific test for this virus.
I would ask you, too, for people that don't understand about the importance of testing. First of all, I don't know what kind of turnaround you all have on this. The four-hour test that we just talked to Dr. Byron Crawford, which is really not, because he said it takes about, I guess because of batching or what have you, 12 hours to get the test out. But I could see where that would have a difference. That's not a statistical difference only. That's a medical difference, right, in terms of what patients go where. And what's the timeline that you all are looking at on getting results back?
Yeah, and that too has evolved since we first began. So if I could just walk you through some of the major
sure.
milestones that happens. So when a patient feels like they're sick and they call their physician and the physician says, hey, yes, you need to be collected, go to this place and get your sample collected. Once that sample is collected, then we have couriers that run statewide that pick up these samples. They get them back to our lab very quickly, but, you know, that does take hours to drive from different places around the state. Then we receive it into our laboratory, our computer tracking system, prep the sample. Then we do what's called an extraction. And so as you've probably seen these collection kits, it's like a large Q-tip type swab that's put up in the person's nose, and then it's put into a tube full of liquid, broken off, and the cap is screwed on. So that liquid helps to keep that virus RNA stable until it can get to the lab. So we extract the virus RNA, the virus and its RNA, off of that swab. And then after we do some chemicals and we extract that off, then we're actually multiplying that DNA and measuring it. And so just those steps there, in the beginning, we could do that in about 6 to 8 hours, you know, when we were doing a sample here and a sample there. And so the more you get, the more you batch. So I think the longest when we went from, you know, seeing 75 samples to 150 to 300, you know, when we went to that kind of rapid uptick, our turnaround times were more like 2 to 3 days. Now we're down to consistently 2 days. So if it gets collected and picked up by us one day, it's late the next day when we're reporting it. We actually just got a new piece of equipment in the end of last week that'll be going online this week, and we're working very hard to get the next day turnaround so that we have you know, more of a 24-hour to 1 day turnaround. So we're constantly that's been kind of a theme of this response, has been that we're constantly having to improve, constantly see where we can speed things up without compromising any quality of the specimen or the results.
We'll take a break, pick it up here. We come back. If you have any comments or questions, you can text them to 87870. We're talking to Mendy Richard. She's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Office of Public Health, and talking about coronavirus, COVID-19 testing. Right now, we stop for a look at traffic on WWL. 9:21, Monday, April 6th. It is Holy Week for Christians, in case you've lost track of all of that. We're talking to Mendy Richard, Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Office of Public Health, about testing for coronavirus. If I can get to some of the questions that are coming in, and then I have a couple of my own for you. My son was tested a week ago at Ilario. When will he get results? How is it determined what test goes where, Mendy?
So as I mentioned earlier, the state public health lab, we're focused right now on patients who are in the hospital, first responders and healthcare workers who have symptoms, so that we can get those folks back in the swim of things if they are negative. So we have not been focused on the folks that we call ambulatory, those folks that are still, you know, at home, moving around, even if they are beginning to feel sick. Those samples are done by some of the commercial laboratories. And I do know there has been some confusion for people having their testing as to where to go for lab results. And so, in fact, the city put together some call strategies in order to make sure people were getting their results at some of those locations. But it is a little confusing for folks to understand where the samples are going and when to expect and how to expect their results. But for the state public health lab, those results go right back to the doctor that ordered them or the facility who ordered the test.
There are patients that are asymptomatic and have the coronavirus within them, which means they don't show any symptoms, correct?
That's true.
But are there people that have the coronavirus where it doesn't show up, but they can still pass it on, or it's incubating, or is that just complete and total science nonsense?
Well, if you think about the testing that we're doing, if a person is tested and they're being tested for the virus, this is really a DNA test. You know, it's RNA, but it is very, very specific. If the sample's collected properly and handled properly, it's very seldom that we get what we call a false positive or a positive result that's not truly positive. So if a person is COVID positive, then they have the virus in that sample. And now how infectious or transmit, that's the part where, you know, the social distancing and isolation, because it is so highly transmissible that we really need folks to stay home, particularly if they have learned that they have a positive test.
Maybe I should have asked about a false negative. Is if they have it, are you going to darn well sure know it?
Well, there are certain circumstances where you could get a false negative test. I mean, if the sample was not collected properly or transmitted properly. And when I say that, you know, so when I mentioned earlier that our courier goes around the state and picks up these samples, that sounds like an easy task, but these samples have to be kept at very specific temperatures. They have to be refrigerated between 2 and 8 degrees Celsius, which is only a 6 degree temperature range. We have our couriers with plug-in coolers that are in their car that keep those samples at exactly that temperature. If they were to arrive at the lab at the wrong temperature, we would have to reject that specimen and have the patient and collect it entirely over again. We can also accept frozen samples if they're on dry ice. So you can see how that transport is so critical to making sure that we get a good and valid sample. I think that we're doing a really good job of that at the state health lab. Our invalid samples that get through the door and get through the testing and then turn out to be invalid or not good samples, that we've only had one out of about 3,700 tested. And that's like 0.03%. So we seem to be doing a very good job in managing that what we call pre-analytic factors. And so a false negative, there's always an opportunity for a false positive or a false negative in any laboratory test. But we believe we're keeping those at a very, very low rate at the state public health lab.
You know, we hear about PPEs, and we're going to talk tomorrow, as a matter of fact, at WWLTV.com. You'll see it's the number one trending story. A letter, I guess, from a nurse, Ann Cerniglia, an ICU nurse at Our Lady of the Lake Hospital. We're going to talk to her tomorrow morning to get her story of what it's like on the front lines. And while I guess the people in a lab don't have necessarily the human aspect of this or the dramatic aspect of this, and I don't say that in a flippant way in any or a pejorative way at all. I mean, there is. It does get more dramatic than human beings living and dying and dealing with the families. And along those lines, the people in the lab may not necessarily have that, but you do have the same, if not more, exposure to the virus or the likes of catching it. Along those lines, do you guys have all of the PPEs that you need?
We do, but like all the hospitals as well, we've had to be very vigilant about that. You know, the one of the things I can mention again about the people that do this testing, maybe this is important to say, you know, it's not like there's thousands of workers there at the lab and they all know how to do this test. You know, we have 85 people at the Baton Rouge Public Health Laboratory, and we began this. Only four people did this type of methodology. Now, we've trained more people internally, but, you know, we're still talking about 12 people who can do this testing. And so one of the main things, these folks are selfless. They have put their own safety at risk, honestly, to do this work. And we value that that PPE so much that we monitor it almost daily to make sure that our levels are not at risk. Because it would shut us down if we were unable to get the personal protective equipment. Now, we work hand in hand with the Governor's Office of Homeland Security, and so if we see that any of our levels are dipping down, we sound the alarm and we make sure that they know that we have to get some more. But you're right, you know, where our tubes don't cough and sneeze on us and we're not intubating people with those respiratory droplets, these are the samples where the virus is inside there. And so our folks work with the PPE. You know, they have the gowns, the gloves, the N95s, and they also work under these hoods. And so if you would, it's like almost like an aquarium type thing where you slip your hands in there and the air is being sucked up and out. And so it creates this negative air pressure flow to pull any respiratory droplets out of their workspace.
I guess a question comes in here that I would think you'd be able to answer. Can COVID-19 be spread through blood or perspiration or other bodily fluids, or is it only respiratory?
I know it to only be respiratory, but I'm not a physician, and I haven't seen the latest studies to see if that is, you know, if they've done more research to determine that. To this point, all I'm aware of is that it's a respiratory spread.
In terms of the whole testing procedure, would it have made a difference if, for whatever reason, the testing would have started earlier or more resources were devoted to it, or could there have been more resources devoted to it?
You know, I think what makes this response so different than so many other things, because, you know, we've had other responses, but I think that what's different is the whole world's being affected by it at the same time, roughly, within a matter of several months. You know, we're all trying to get the same materials. There is no safe place to go. There is no one producer that's supplying one area at a time. And so I think that it would be naive, maybe, for me to propose that we would have been able to do it better than we did. I do think that the manufacturing industry has responded as well as they could have. I think that now we're pressing the supply and demand chains. You know, we're battling every day with our suppliers to get us the reagents, we call them, the ingredients that we need to run the testing. And so they're actually having to ration and prioritize. And so we have, and what we've done to try to get ahead of this is we've actually set up different ways of doing the testing on different pieces of equipment. And so if we can't get one set of reagents, we can flex and go to the other set. But it's made us manage our laboratory processes differently than we've ever had to do before. So I think it's a bit unprecedented, but I think we're all doing the best we can, including the manufacturing industry as well.
Anything you'd like to add before we let you go?
No, I think that I just would implore everybody, our leadership in our state has been remarkable, and you know, the message that keeps going out is to take this seriously. This is for your safety. It's for the safety of your loved ones, particularly the vulnerable. And I would say that a big thank you to all the healthcare workers and first responders who are showing up despite their fear and their risk. And let's all do our part in helping keep them safe by following the directions that have been given to isolate and to use social distancing. So thank you so much for the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming on. We appreciate your work. We really do. Mendy Richard, Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Office of Public Health. We may not know.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.